This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On Saturday, President Donald Trump will reach his 100th day in office. It's an arbitrary benchmark, but one that's come into common use as a measurement of presidential performance. The Trump administration is touting job creation, regulation cuts, and national security as just some of the president's accomplishments. But the courts have blocked his immigration ban, Congress failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and investigations of Russian efforts to influence last November's election continue. Joining us for a look at President Trump's first 100 days are political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken and Howard, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, guys. Looking forward to it.
And Ken, before we start our discussion, what is the trivia question?
Howard. Is Howard there?
Yes.
Yeah,
he's
kind of chimed in there. No, he's here.
He's cool. Okay, I got nervous.
I'm just shy.
Oh, yeah, right. what's the trivia question today, Ken?
Well, with all the focus on the 100 days, now we know that William Henry Harrison never got to reach 100 days as president because he died 31 days into his term. But who was the most recent vice president who served fewer than 100 days in office?
Okay. Most recent vice president who did not serve 100 days in office. If you think you know the answer...
Fewer.
Okay. Yeah. All right. If you think you know the answer, call 513-419-7100. And the first correct phone call is going to win a political junkie button, 513-419-7100. So, Ken, with all this talk of 100 days, how long has this first 100 days benchmark been around? I mean, where did this whole thing come from?
Well, it's been around for about 100 days. No, it's actually been around since FDR. Yeah. And what Franklin Roosevelt accomplished in his first 100 days. Now, of course, back then the president wasn't sworn in until March, so it went from March until June. But he had 313 Democrats in the House and 59 Democrats in the Senate. And but basically, you know, it's interesting how Donald Trump talked about the mess he inherited when he came into office, which was like 5% unemployment. But, I mean, what FDR inherited in 1933 was indeed a mess, with millions out of work and banks failing and all and closing and all those things. So what he accomplished in those 100 days, it's a benchmark that not only no president has ever reached since then, but no president should even try to. And what's remarkable of what Donald Trump is doing is that throughout the whole campaign, all the things he says I would pledge to do on my first 100 days, and he gave a speech last week. He said, I have been the most successful president in the 100 days in history. And he said that on Maria Bartiromo's show on Fox Business the other day, too. But he also tweeted, and this is the part where I agree with Trump, that it's a ridiculous standard. It's an artificial and ridiculous standard. And I think it is, but for somebody who campaigned on everything he was going to accomplish in his first 100 days and how great he's been doing in his first 100 days, which is very debatable, that's the part I find fault with him.
Right. He set this bar for himself. He did it back at that speech in Gettysburg during the campaign, where he laid out, you know, what he was going to do in his first 100 days. Now, FDR, you know, when he came in 1933, obviously in the middle of the Great Depression, there was a lot of, you know, people were demanding action. And as Ken said, he had this overwhelmingly Democratic Congress that passed all of this massive amount of legislation, creating all these alphabet soup agencies, the WPA, CCC, all of this stuff. A lot of it ended up in the Supreme Court being challenged and knocked down. But he was under pressure to act quickly. So he set that bar for himself and other presidents and the media itself over the years has taken that up as the measuring stick. I don't know why. It might as well be 98 days.
Well, and also you don't really know what you're going to get in the first 100 days and how it will determine whether the president is a success or not. And I, of course, I always think of JFK and the Bay of Pigs botched invasion in April of 1961. That was within his first 100 days. It was a disaster, a humiliating defeat. But it turned out that, you know, the historians give Kennedy much better credit, more credit than just on that botched Bay of Pigs invasion.
And Kennedy, I honestly don't remember this. What was there? Was there this much coverage and this much hype about the first 100 days, say, in President Bush's first 100 days or President Obama's first 100 days?
Well, actually, Obama talked about it back then. He said, this is really ridiculous. I mean, you really can't decide to judge anything in the first 100 days. Maybe give me a year or something, but I'm not trying to compete with the other presidents. What makes this different, and I do remember us talking about Reagan's first 100 days and Clinton's first 100 days, but what makes this different is that Trump talked about it nonstop on the campaign trail. Here's what I will accomplish in the first 100 days, and in those two conversations he's had in the past week, that I've surpassed the accomplishments of any other president. And I think he, as Howard said, he brought it on himself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's been talked about by other presidents, obviously. And I think part of it is just the pace at which this guy operates. I mean, it's, you know, it's a different issue every day. It's something, you know, I mean, things have been going at the speed of light in this administration, you know.
But what has he accomplished? That's
right,
the other question,
what has he
too.
Accomplished?
And what he said yesterday may not be what he said today about the same issue.
Exactly.
Like, for example, China being a currency manipulator. So,
but now it's
there
not.
Are a lot of things. Exactly right. So yeah, I mean, I think of FDR's, I mean, I don't remember because I was younger than Howard back then. But I mean, I still think of FDR's fireside chats, which I guess is kind of like Trump's tweets back then. So, look, he was a great communicator. FDR was a great communicator. But remember, he was elected in 1932 with 59% of the vote. Donald Trump had fewer votes, fewer percentages than his Democratic opponent. And right now, his job approval numbers is the lowest since they've been grading presidents, I guess, which started around Eisenhower's time. So,
that's right.
So, I mean, it's not much to show for 100 days. But again, I agree with him in the sense that it is a ridiculous standard, and we have things can change on a dime.
None of the legislative things that he proposed, none of that legislation has actually been introduced.
Or that's a
there's
good point.
There's been no legislation, right?
Right,
exactly.
None, zero.
You can divide
there's
this up into
of
two
executive orders.
Yeah, you can right. You can divide it up into two categories: executive orders and things he has to accomplish legislatively. And it seems like on the executive order side, I think I heard he has 29 at this point that he signed. So,
and he campaigned against Barack Obama and his executive orders. I mean, yes, he has done a lot of what he promised with executive orders.
Yes.
They haven't all come to pass. But on, for example, on the Keystone Pipeline, on the partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade, a lot of the environmental standards.
Deregulation,
absolutely. This is what he campaigned on, and he's done it with executive orders. And Sean Spicer last week said, when he was talking about the 100-day record, he said, well, look at all these executive orders. And yet, remember, he campaigned criticizing all of Obama's executive orders, just as Obama campaigned criticizing all of George W. Bush's executive orders. And yet, I guess it's a different story when you're president.
Hey, Ken, give the trivia question again. Let's see if we can get some more people to try their hand at this.
So we're talking a lot about the 100 days, but here's a question about the vice president. Who was the most recent vice president who served fewer than 100 days in office?
Okay, if you think you know the answer to that, 513-419-7100 is the phone number to call. The first correct call will win a political junkie button. Ken promises you that. 513-419-7100. So, Ken, any other thoughts at this point on these first 100 days?
No, not really. It seems, though, that, you know, it seems like the president is trying to force as much as he's saying it's a ridiculous standard. He's trying to force as much accomplishments or make as much happen this week, in the lead up to the Saturday's 100 days. But announcing a tax cut plan is not the same thing as accomplishing anything. And again, you know, for all we know, we may even have a vote on the health care substitute as opposed to the one that failed last month. So he is trying very hard to make this a very successful week, knowing that, you know, everybody will turn around Saturday and judge and say, okay, how has his 100 days been? But again, it's silly, but that's what the media do, and that's what the historians do, and that's what Trump do.
And he knows that that's what all the Sunday talk shows will be about exactly. The 100 days.
Yeah, and then I had heard that they were going to try to vote on this on Saturday, but
yeah. Right.
Yeah, right.
And that's what, remember the Paul Ryan tried to get the Republicans to vote on the health care bill on the anniversary when Barack Obama has his sign. I mean, it's an artificial standard. Get the vote. We don't care if it takes 100 days or a year or something. It's just get it. If you want to get accomplishments, you have to make sure you have the votes to pass it, and not just to get it out by some artificial deadline.
Well, I get the impression that Paul Ryan is not going to bring something to a vote until he knows that he's
got not going to make that same mistake. Exactly, I agree. Yeah.
So
Trump says.
Yeah, 100 days or not, he doesn't. Right. He wants to make sure that...
I mean, Donald Trump's trying to put it on Paul Ryan, but Paul Ryan is not going to go through that. He's not going to become the next John Boehner.
And that's why I don't... I really wonder if they're going to have a vote on Saturday on the healthcare.
Yeah, I do too. I really can't imagine it, but,
Because they've made it more acceptable to the Freedom Caucus conservatives, but it's alienating more and more Republican moderates. And assuming there's a united Democratic opposition, I mean, it may have a majority in the Republican caucus, but it may not pass the House. And that's what Ryan desperately wants to do.
Right. This idea
and that's
of
what
doing,
they promised.
This idea of doing away with the coverage for pre-existing conditions is a big problem for these Republican moderates.
Right. Right. They would raise the insurance rates on them. Right. Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we will be back after this to talk more with Ken and Howard and to let you try your hand at Ken's trivia question. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, we have some people lined up to try the trivia question, so why don't you give that to us again, and then we'll see if anybody can come up with the right answer to this.
Well, we keep talking about presidents and 100 days, but here's a vice presidential question. Who is the most recent vice president who served fewer than 100 days in office?
Okay, Bill in Union, Kentucky. Hi, Bill. Who do you think it was?
Well, I'd assume from the way he asked the question that he means served in the office of vice president. So I'm going to say Gerald Ford.
Okay. Ken?
Gerald Ford's a good guess. I mean, of course, he became the vice president after Spiro Agnew was resigned over scandals. But Gerald Ford served almost a year, maybe two-thirds of a year, from 1973 to 1974. And that's almost, three-quarters of a year, which is more than 100 days.
Okay, Jan in Hamilton. Hi, Jan. Who do you think it was?
Hi, I think it was Spiro Agnew, maybe.
Well, actually, Spiro Agnew served. Remember, when he resigned in 1973, he was already reelected vice president in 1972. So he was already vice president for over 4 years.
Okay, Alan in Centerville. Alan,
it would be Harry Truman in 1944.
Ken,
it would be Harry Truman in 1945.
Because inauguration day to Roosevelt's death in April.
Exactly right. He only served 82 days. That's the correct answer. Let's hear the applause.
Yay!
Very good.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good.
But Harry Truman served only 82 days as vice president. He was sworn in March for vice president. No, in January. But then FDR died in April of 1945. He only served 82 days. And of course, when he was president, the news about dropping the bomb, I mean, he had no idea about anything that was going on. It was pretty remarkable.
Right. I guess Roosevelt could have educated him better, but...
You're right.
Alan, congratulations. And
thank you.
Stay on the line so we can find out where to send your prize to. And again,
Truman was in that. Remember that Truman was in that great movie when Harry Met Sally?
No. It was the Truman Show. You and I have argued about this endlessly.
Right. Oh, sorry.
You're wrong, Ken.
Sorry.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So let's talk about Trump's tax cut plan. Howard, your thoughts on this at this point?
Well, right now it's basically a bunch of bullet points. I mean, it's not legislation.
So what do you mean? I mean, he's laid out, outlined
he's outlined, taxes for middle-income people, big tax cuts, for business. The one problem with this that appears to be a concern to some in Congress is, we've been down this road before. The Reagan administration did this big tax cuts. It did not grow the economy, as Donald Trump says this will. And he had to go back and actually increase taxes. And I just think that Congress is going to look at this and say, hey, is this really going to stimulate the economy and bring in more revenue to a point where we're revenue neutral?
Ken?
Yeah, no, I agree with Howard completely. I mean, with Ronald Reagan, he's absolutely right. He raised taxes by a tremendous amount in 1981, and then these huge deficits appeared.
Yeah.
He also had a Democratic House led by Tip O'Neill, and of course the Democratic House was hitting him on the deficits and a growing recession. Trump has a Republican House. He has a Republican Senate. But again, Howard is exactly right as regarding the fact that there were no, it was just an outline. There are no details. And I think Democrats ask, rightly or wrongly, that will this plan benefit Donald Trump? Of course, we'll never know because we don't see his taxes. But for Donald Trump to say, I'm going to do this about taxes and do this about tax reform and lower the rates, to 35% for individuals and 15% for businesses. But how does it affect him, Trump Industries and all that?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a legitimate question that that even some Republicans are asking, saying that, it may be going too far, even though he has both houses of Congress with his party.
But a lot of those Republicans in Congress are going to want to know if these tax cuts would end up paying for themselves.
And plus, if it's going to raise deficits over 10
right.
years, there's a law, a rule in Congress that
you can't
do something like that.
No.
That after 10 years will be a deficit. And we're talking an unbelievable amount for the deficit, exactly.
Yeah, so I think we're going to have to wait and see. There's some meat on the bone here. I mean, basically we've got a bunch of, as I say, bullet points, talking points. Here's what, I want to do. But tax reform is very tricky legislation, and it's very complicated legislation. And I think we're going to have to wait until we actually see a bill.
But how would you agree that the reason he brought this out yesterday was because this is the deadline week for 100 days?
You bet.
And he wanted to make people sound like he was accomplishing something?
Well, absolutely.
Something.
No, yeah. No question about it. And, now that's the discussion. That and health care. Those are the two things that people are talking about. And he's trying to put the onus on Paul Ryan and the moderates in Congress, say, hey, do something about this. I've made my proposals. Now it's up to you.
And Ken, you go ahead, Ken.
I'm just going to say, it sounds like, though, that Trump is being more involved in the tax conversations.
Yeah.
Maybe as a businessman, he knows more about this than he was in the healthcare. In the healthcare stuff, he basically sat back and said, Paul, Ryan, do your magic. But I think he's more involved in here, or at least his administration is more involved than they were in the healthcare bill.
Well, and that's why the Democrats are going to have a very strong argument to make with the public when they start talking about, hey, how many of these tax cuts actually benefit Trump and his family and his personal business interests? And I think the answer is going to be a lot of them.
And Ken, you brought up, well, what effect is this going to have on the deficit? They talk about paying for this with the economic growth it would generate. But deficit versus national debt. I thought economic growth is going to help bring down the national debt. Can we do both things?
Well, ostensibly, that was the argument, and that's the argument that Reagan made as well. If it didn't work for Reagan, and there's no guarantee it works for Trump, I mean, we don't know. I mean, there are supply-side economists who still will continue to make the argument that this is exactly the kind of kickstart the economy needs. But you could also make the case that you know, given the rise in employment figures and the rise in confidence in the economy, it may not need that extreme tax cut, both for businesses and individuals, to jumpstart the economy.
Right, and as we said before, it's taken place in the past and not worked very well.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can, and you wanted to add something to that, Howard?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like Ken said, there's a whole lot of people in this country who want to see tax reform of one type or another. I don't think they necessarily need it to happen in the next 2 days. And that makes you question whether, you know, what the timing of this whole thing. Because of the 100 days, the talk shows on Sunday are going to be about nothing but this.
And again, if you'd like to join us, you can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. What about the government shutdown at this point? There's been a lot of talk about that could happen. Where's that stand?
Well, it looks like it's on hold now.
Yeah, what's so funny about this, I'm funny with more ironic than funny, but one of Donald Trump's non-negotiable demands during the campaign was the building of the wall. And, of course, Mexico would pay for it. And now, of course, Mexico won't pay for it. And now he's asking, I mean, the cost of the wall is probably $22 billion, which is, Paul Ryan is not about to put that money into a budget. There is no money in the budget for that kind of expenditure. And the Democrats say this is a non-starter from the beginning. And even Republicans say, look, this is not what we want to do, what we need to do. And as far as the argument that the border is more porous than ever, that's not true. I mean, there is more of a crackdown. There are more deportations than there had been in a while. But there is also fewer people coming across the border. The thought of a $22 billion wall and certainly Mexico paying for it both seem to be just nonsensical. Speaking of Mexico, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, Ken, I mean, does it seem to you that Trump kind of backed down on that?
He did. That's exactly right. He talked about what he would say one day and change his mind.
Right.
Now he says, okay, if we don't get the war, we're going to shut down the government. And I said, well, you know, I can wait till September.
Right.
I mean, that's what he does.
Yeah. But then he puts out tweets, you know, aimed at his supporters saying, no, don't worry, we're still going to build this wall.
Yep. And the polls show that, you know, an overwhelming, and when I mean overwhelming, I'm talking about 96% or something of his supporters stay with him. They don't.
Oh, yeah.
They still Absolutely. Feel he's doing the right job. They still feel that, you know, the moderates and the media and the Democrats are holding him back. But they don't feel they're not disappointed with him. They're looking at his foreign policy as well. And we should talk about that, too, about what he's accomplished and what he hasn't accomplished. But they're looking at a president who has stuck by his guns and kept his promises. And he has not deserted or disappointed his supporters as of yet.
But overall, I think the polls tend to show that this wall does not have a great deal of support.
No, from either party. Right.
Yeah.
Ken, did you hear Ted Cruz's proposal for paying for the wall? Did you pick up on that?
No.
Okay. This is interesting. I want to see how both of you react to this because
either, wait, is this Mark. The money he got from Lee Harvey Oswald?
No, that was low. He's talking about paying for it with the asset forfeiture money, assets seized from drug cartels or drug lords, for instance, El Chapo. Taking, I think it's roughly $14 billion they got from him, taking that money combined with some other drug lords and using that to pay for the wall.
You know, there was a great story in the Washington Post this week about a Republican congressman named Will Hurd, who's in a very Democratic district, but he's a very good and effective congressman, a Republican, who says the wall is exactly not what we need to do. Where, you know, it's just wrong. It's hurting our relationship with Mexico. And I was just listening. Next week on my podcast, I have Craig Shirley, who just wrote a new biography of Ronald Reagan. And I was listening to Ronald Reagan's candidacy announcement for president in 1979. And a lot of it talked about how important good relationships with Canada and Mexico are.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump just seems to do the opposite. You know, I don't know what's going on with Russia right now, although we know what he said about Putin during the campaign. But the things he's been saying about Mexico and now Canada, our two closest allies, our closest trading partners, it just seems so self-defeating and and vintage Donald Trump.
Pointless, yeah. I mean, why antagonize those people, our closest neighbors?
Well, where do things stand with NAFTA? Because I know it's been talked that he was going to drop out of that deal.
He said that he's not going to do it right away, but, you know, I think the long-range plan is still to sign a order saying we are removing ourselves, the United States, from NAFTA.
Right, renegotiate it, right.
We'll negotiate it, yeah.
Okay, so renegotiate, and if that doesn't go well, then we drop out.
Right.
513.
Unless he changes his mind, right?
Right, until, yeah. All right.
513-419-7100. Let's talk to Wes in Cincinnati. Hi, Wes.
Hi. Great program. I always look forward to listening to it.
Thank you.
My comment is about the question is about the tax code for businesses that I read. I can't remember the source offhand, but a really respected economist said the effective tax rate is really 12 or 13% because of all the massive and numerous complex deductions. So my question is, if individuals are limiting everything but mortgage deductions and charitable contributions, nobody's talking about that effect. What's the real effective tax rates, for instance, for a big corporation and then for smaller corporations and S-Corp? And the second one is that won't a lot of, people on Wall Street, investment bankers and all that sort of set up an S-Corp so they can pay an effective 15% tax rate versus this 35? See what I mean? They'll try to disguise, because he's making it also for S corporations, which are notorious for all kinds of things.
Well, I'm clearly not an expert on the details. Well, first of all, there are not that many details out so far.
Yes.
But I think Wes is right. The new way they want to write the laws. For businesses, there are loopholes that there's sham changes that these corporations can use with these new proposed tax laws that will not bring in the kind of money that people thought and may actually hurt the economy more often than not. And Wes also points out about these deductions that once upon a time individual taxpayers could write off, about state and local taxes, for example, or inheritance fees and things like that. That's going to go down as well. And so, yes, it's nice that individuals will go down from like 39% to 35%. But if they lose all those deductions, I'm not sure, and I don't know how much that benefits individual people.
I don't know. It could end up being a wash.
Well, part of the Trump plan is to double the standard deduction.
Yeah.
I think on a married couple, it would go to about $24,000. Yeah. So that's part of the plan. It's not just reducing the rates, but it's also also increasing the standard deduction that you can take without itemizing. Mm. So maybe you get it back that way. But he does have a good point. I mean, corporations hire attorneys and accountants and auditors and all kinds of people to help them pay the lowest possible tax rate that they can, so you have to wonder how many companies really do pay the complete 35% these days.
Look, Donald Trump said it himself. He said, look, my job is to, with Trump Industries, is to pay as little taxes as possible. And he said that, and he didn't apologize for that. And there were just more and more opportunities for these corporations to pay as little as possible and perhaps even less than desired or warranted. So there's just a lot of things that are not even in the small print that we have to watch that.
Right. And that's going to take a long period of time to hash out.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk to Suzanne in Fairfield. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, here was my question. It's not really about Donald Trump. It's about the new head of the DNC. I was calling to ask Mr. Rudin's opinion about how he thinks Mr. Perez is going to be able to attract new members to the Democratic Party with being so far extreme to the left with like excluding anyone that's pro-life. Whatever happened to what they're called, blue dog Democrats. I think
and
those
the
are a thing of the past. And yeah. That was my question.
Yeah. Suzanne, thank you.
I'll tell you why I love this question is because what Tom Perez has done is very interesting what's going on. First, Tom Perez and Bernie Sanders just recently did a magical mystery tour around the country trying to build up the Democratic Party. And they went into Omaha where the Democratic candidate for mayor voted for a bill that requires women to check out ultrasounds before they get an abortion. And that is a no-no. It's anathema to pro-choice NARAL folks and like that. So Bernie Sanders supports that candidate and got a lot of heat from pro-choice Democrats saying you shouldn't be doing that. But what Tom Perez did was the complete opposite. Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, said the party should not support any Democrat who takes a pro-life position, which is a remarkable thing to say. First of all, you can forget about Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer ever becoming the majority leader in either party, in either chamber, if they're going to write off pro-life Democrats. And what about the Bob Caseys and the John Testers and the Joe Manchins and the Joe Donnellys, all those senators who were up in 2018?
Sure.
The Democratic Party is not going to back candidates who are opposed to abortion. I mean, I've never heard a Democratic chair say, look, the Democrats are a pro-choice party, and they acknowledge it. But to write off pro-life Democrats, to say that the party is not going to support them, that is just, so self-defeating.
Ken, this is exactly the same kind of thing that the Democratic Party has been after the Republicans about for decades. That they exclude people, that they don't have a big tent, that they won't listen to other points of view. That has been their criticism of the Republican Party. Now they seem to be contracting within themselves and excluding people. And that is a road that could lead to disaster for them.
You know, Sam, I understand that the Democratic Party has moved to the left since Hillary Clinton's defeat. I know that the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, although Bernie Sanders, he said he would support pro-life candidates, but whatever. But the point is, it has moved to the left, and I understand that. But to write off, if the Democrats ever want to take back control of the Senate, and you're going to let Joe Donnelly and Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp and other pro-life Democrats, cut them loose and not support them, they're just defeating themselves.
You can't win.
It was a remarkable mistake by Perez. And I wonder I wonder how the party leaders are trying to deal with it now, because he said what he said, and it didn't go over well.
We will continue our conversation with Ken and Howard. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tim in Cincinnati joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I'm wondering if the 3 or 4% of the solid Trump voters are not with him anymore, would they be enough to have flipped the election back in November?
Well, Tim, are you saying that if they could do the election all over again? Is that what you're saying?
No, I guess my point is that we're all, oh my God, everything's over in the Trump camp. It was a really 50-50 election, as we all know.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that we're so afraid of what he is, and I don't think it's as solid as what it purports to be. I think that gradually people are going to come to understand that it isn't what they thought they were voting for. And my question was, if it was that tight in November, that if those 3 or 4% that are now dissatisfied with them, if they had voted the other way, would that have been enough to flip the election?
Well, it was only about 80,000 people in three different states that decided this election by voting for Trump.
It was Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that decided the election.
Right.
So you could have had millions of people changing their vote in other states, and I don't know what would have mattered.
Right.
There was a poll that came out this week that if the election were held today, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, and of course that won't happen in 2020, but if it were, Trump would win 43-40. Now, the point is that a lot depends on who the Democrats put up. Let's just say in 2020 or whenever you want to say, you know. But the point is, you can't, you know, if it's a far left Democrat in 2020, that 4% might come back to Trump.
Right.
If Trump steadies his course, he could grow in popularity. But if he still attacks, you know, everybody as their enemies, he still goes after the, you know, crooked Hillary and the crooked media and all that. It just gets very wary, and that 4% of the Trump people who are not with him now could grow to 14% or 40% or whatever. So we have a long way to go, but it just would be interesting to see how long if his support does seem to wither away, because right now he's the most unpopular first-term president in memory, 40% or so in the Gallup polls, with job approval of 40%. And until the Democrats come up with an alternative, and, you know, and maybe they will have an alternative in 2018 and 2020. But right now, his numbers are not as good as they should be for a new president.
You know, a lot of the Trump voters I talk to around in this area, they're watching very closely to see if he delivers. If he delivers on the issues that they were really interested in. Those were, you know, things like immigration and tax reform too. They were interested in that, and they have a very deep interest in that. Whether or not they're going to like what they see coming out of the Trump administration on something like tax reform, I don't know. But I don't think it would take very much to turn a sufficient number of people against him.
One thing we haven't talked about in this show at all is foreign policy. And, you know, it's one thing to say that what he did in response to Syria's chemical weapons, dropping the bomb on the Tomahawk missiles on the Syrian Air Force base, the air base. A lot of people say, well, it was insufficient, but it certainly was more than Barack Obama did when he drew his red line about chemical weapons. So I will give, whatever you think about a response to Syria, Donald Trump delivered and Obama did not. But I don't know. I'm a little worried, nervous about how we're responding to North Korea, because that country to say it's irrational is an understatement. But to talk about nuclear weapons and military responses casually, and sometimes it feels like the president is talking about it casually, I don't think it's hyperbole to say that it could just launch. I mean, who knows what it could launch coming out of North Korea, but it's frightening, and I think there needs to be some adults in the room when we're talking about what could be a nuclear holocaust.
It's a very dangerous situation. You know, you had chief of the U.S. Pacific Command going to Congress just yesterday saying that the Pentagon needed to beef up anti-ballistic missiles in Hawaii because of the fear of being attacked by North Korea. I mean, this is real. And as Ken says, we need adults in the room making these decisions.
What was it? It was like last weekend, North Korea put out a statement that we were within just minutes of thermonuclear war.
Sure.
So,
I mean, it almost seems like a Woody Allen movie, except for the fact that it's real and lives are at stake. And I mean, look, no president, Democrat or Republican, has ever been able to deal with the Pyongyang regime, and whether it's Kim's father or grandfather, although I heard his father was ill. I'm sorry, that was Kim Jong-il. I'm sorry. But I'll use that joke forever. But, yeah. I mean, and I shouldn't make jokes at a time we're talking about nuclear wars, but no administration has ever been able to solve this dilemma. You have sanctions, then you take them off. I mean, George W. Bush removed North Korea as a certain nation of whatever. I forgot what the term was, because he tried to induce it for negotiations.
Right.
Nothing seems to work with them. More sanctions. Nothing. And that's why Trump is talking more to China than he ever expected to do, because he thinks China may have some leverage with Kim, and actually they may not.
Well, and China's starting to put the squeeze on them a little bit, too. I mean, they're, you know, withholding that's where they get their gasoline for their vehicles. And China's holding back on them. They're putting the squeeze on North Korea.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us, and let's talk to Sue in Dark County. Hi, Sue.
Hi, good afternoon. I was just calling to see if you guys would give a hypothesis on why you thought perhaps Mr. Perez, on their wonderful Democratic tour, included Bernie Sanders, an independent who doesn't really like things on both sides, and left Ellison sitting at home.
I missed what you said about sitting at home.
She's wondering why Sanders went on the tour with Perez as opposed to taking the co-chair Ellison along on the
Keith
trip.
Ellison,
Well,
Bernie Sanders is the most popular non-Democrat in the country. I mean, his numbers are very, very high. He has a great support within the party, and he wants to have them win. And he cares a lot about economic security and things like that. But the fact is that Bernie Sanders, as Sue points out, is not a Democrat. Two, he supported Ellison over Tom Perez. They're not the best friends. So it was almost like a shotgun marriage in the fact that they were campaigning together. But again, the difference on abortion was just so stark with the abortion proponents criticizing Sanders for backing a pro-life candidate in Omaha and pro-life folks screaming at Perez for writing them off from the party. It seemed like a very ill thought out idea. I mean, I understand that the Democrats want to come back, and we've seen some kind of gains or at least encouraging thing for the Democrats in the special elections in Kansas and Georgia. And that may portend some good things for the Democrats and maybe portend good things for 2018. But to try to go on this tour to help the party, and ultimately I think it hurt the party, is just, boy, it was just a nice try. Inexcusable.
It was a nice try. But, I mean, you know, and taking Ellison along, I mean, doesn't really exactly have the star power that Bernie Sanders does.
Exactly.
I mean, Bernie Sanders will draw a crowd.
Right. Who knows who exactly?
Who knows who
Keith Ellison is? Right, exactly.
Let's talk to Brent in Terrace Park. Hi.
Hey, guys. Great discussion. I want to thank Public Radio for putting together people who really get to the facts and allow the listener to think for themselves. That's one of the great things about Public Radio. And I really appreciate, Howard, your delivery and whenever I hear you're going to be on the radio, I stay tuned. So thanks to everybody.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My question to you guys is, I would like some editorial in the sense of, give us a letter grade for the president the first 100 days in your own opinion.
Well, on my Political Junkie program this week, I had Mara Liasson on as a guest, and her grade was incomplete. And I think that's a fair grade. I mean, I don't think, for example, I don't think the health care, the failure to get a health care bill was a defeat, because if they come up with a new plan in a week or a month or 6 months, people will forget about what happened in March. So I think incomplete is the right grade, but the fact is, nothing has passed. There's no legislation that's passed, even though the Republicans control both houses. It's not higher than a C, but I think incomplete seems the right grade right now.
Yeah, I agree. Call us back in 3 months and ask that question.
Let's see
where we stand at that point, because really, aside from a flurry of executive orders and the military actions that we've talked about, not a whole lot's happened. Nothing's happened legislatively. I mean, not anything.
Right, and things like the travel ban, which he campaigned on, have been thrown out by the courts. The thing on sanctuary cities.
Sanctuary cities is tied up in the courts.
But I really appreciate the caller, what he said in the beginning was what public radio does and what WBXU does in the fact that it welcomes opinions from everybody. These are not 20-second conversations. If you listen to television, if you get, you know, a minute 30 on an issue, you're very lucky. You get a chance to express your views, and we could be wrong, and we could be ill-informed, or we could be, you know, analyzing it incorrectly, but that's what allows... That's what's so good about this show. It allows people to call and say, I think you're right, I think you're wrong, here's what I think. Right. And you can't get that anywhere else but public radio.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we're all saying I.
Yes.
We're all taking the easy way out and saying incomplete. Okay.
Incomplete for now. But, I mean, you know, we're still hung up on this 100-day thing.
Yeah.
Until we get off of that.
Yeah, because it's a four-year term.
Right. It is a four-year term. Well, how many days left?
1,161.
There you go.
Ken's got it easy.
I knew you were counting them off.
He's counting them down.
And by the way, Howard, I listen to you when you're on this show, too. Whenever you're on this show with me, I listen to you. I make sure to listen.
I wanted to touch on this, too.
I listen to you.
I wanted to touch on this, too, before we get done here, about what Howard was just talking about, that Trump's been blocked twice now on his immigration ban by the federal courts, and that including the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he's been blocked on defunding sanctuary cities. So now that Neil Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court, I'm wondering where all this is headed. Is this all going to the Supreme Court?
That's what he says. Matter of fact, he just tweeted, said, I'll see you on the Supreme Court. I mean, perhaps.
Or is that just a negotiating
perhaps.
Point?
Perhaps. Yeah. And he might go to the Supreme Court. When you talk about sanctuary cities, number one, you have to get a legal definition of what a sanctuary city is. And there is none at this point. It's basically whatever a city decides it is. In Cincinnati, we have one definition of it. In San Francisco, they have a different definition of it.
But as Mark just said, I mean, when you think of a president's legacy, having a Supreme Court justice, and in the case of Neil Gorsuch, I mean, he didn't really change the court ideologically, but he probably added 30 years to the fact that a conservative justice would be on the court. And if Anthony Kennedy or Ruth Bader Ginsburg or other moderate or liberals leave the court in the next couple of years, he has a chance to change it even more. So forget about the first 100 days, even though he did have Gorsuch in the first 100 days. When you think of a president's leaves behind, there's probably nothing greater, more important, more consequential than a Supreme Court justice.
That's right.
And Ken, Trump also saying he wants to split up the Ninth Circuit Court. Can he do that?
Yeah. I saw that, and I don't know how he could. Of course he wants to, because it's probably the one based out of San Francisco, one of the more liberal courts of the country. And of course he wants to, I remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger was running for governor, I have a button that says, impeach the Ninth Circuit with a picture of Schwarzenegger on the button. I mean, a lot of conservatives would love it to go away.
Right.
I'm not sure that's possible.
And speaking of differing opinions here, Marvin in Springdale has a comment he wants to make. Marvin, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, I was reacting to the comment.
And Marvin, please, I'm sorry, we're getting short on time, so get to your point real quickly here.
Okay. Perhaps it was Trump's fault that the sarin gas was used by Syria the second time. You'll note when it was used during the Obama administration, it was never used again. Until Trump took office, because he downplayed the significance of Assad, emboldening him to perhaps use it again.
And your contention is you're taking contention with the idea that Obama didn't do anything in regards to Syria, right?
Oh, I didn't say that.
Okay.
He did do something.
No, that's what I'm saying. You're taking contention with that. Right. You're taking contention with the idea that Obama did nothing. You're saying, no, that's not the case. So
I think what if I understand Marvin what he's saying, he said that maybe Syria got a signal from Trump by saying that, well, I'm not going to do anything about Assad, and because Trump is not going to do anything about Russia, maybe it's okay, we can go ahead with more chemical weapons against our own people. It's an interesting theory. I think it's blaming. I mean, the blame is to Assad, not to Trump. Clearly, I think Trump did give signals that he was not going to interfere in Syria, but again, you know, it's whatever difficult. He did, whether it's effective or not, something is happening with it. But I would put the whole blame on Assad and Russia as well.
Right.
And Marvin, thank you for the call. We do appreciate it. Ken, Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.